Welcome to Orphan Entertainment Supplemental. I'm here with a woman who is as classic as the films we are going to talk about. It's Lydia.
Hey. Oh, you did the thing.
I couldn't do it without, couldn't start a show without doing the thing.
I need that little shock to get my adrenaline going.
We also have a special guest to help us kick off our 13th year of the show. He's a film historian, a content creator, and a lover of old films. And beyond that, I'm going to let him tell you himself. Please welcome Harry Marks. Harry, thank you. Welcome to Orphan Entertainment.
Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Just a little background of how I kind of stumbled on you. I spoke to someone from Momitu for my sister podcast, Time Shifters, and he mentioned that they had just started a, what do you call it, a...
streaming service.
No, well, yes, Momitu, Momitu is a new streaming service, but they just started a collaboration with Harry Marks where he is doing introductions for some of their the classic films that they have on the surface. Yep. And they suggested you should get in contact with him. I'm like, wow, that would be a great thing to do for my other podcast. And so here we are. So, Harry, let's start and talk a little bit about you. And we can start with that if you want, or if you want to go back to anything else. But
I actually listened to that episode with Brian at Momitu today. I was it was great, and he reached out to me a couple of months ago, and I guess I'll go back to the beginning. I had started a TikTok channel. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it at the time when I first started it, and I was lurking and things, and I'd come across Turner Classic Movies' Ziz's account. And I noticed they were putting up clips from different classic films. They were doing sort of cutesy captions and emojis and things to sort of spruce up to liven up the clip. But I noticed they, on none of their socials, were they putting up what I love about the channel, which are the introductions. And so I decided I would do that on my channel because I noticed classic film was a pretty untapped niche on TikTok at the time. There were a few big classic film content creators, but no, like, horror is a huge genre on TikTok and social media in general, and it's well covered, but classic film is sort of left out in the rain. So I have a lot of knowledge and love of the history of classic film. My grandfather was in a classic film with Frank Sinatra, and so we can absolutely talk about that later. And I just, it's been a passion of mine. And so, you know, I combined my passion for classic film and history with my passion for Turner Classic Movies. And I started writing and recording my own introductions to classic films with the hope that someone would watch it and then go watch the film like they were, you know, watching TCM. And so during last summer when the writer's strike and the actor strikes were going on, I had pivoted because I didn't want to give any attention to the large studios while these strikes were going on. So I pivoted more to history content, and I did, you know, little documentaries on the Hays Code and the Hollywood Blacklist, and even smaller, like, mini documentaries on the transatlantic accent, why we eat popcorn at the movies, where movie trailers originated, all that kind of stuff. And my channel has grown from there. And so several months ago, I was laid off from my current for my last role. I was writing for a podcast company called Grim and Mild, and doing shows like Cabinet of Curiosities and Lore. I actually have a book on Cabinet of Curiosities coming out in November. When that happened, I had put up a video that was basically hire me. It was a little thing I did with, you know, what I can do. Here's, you know, my sizzle reel, basically. And Brian reached out and was like, let's do something together. And so he said, why don't we do your introductions for movies on Momitu? And so every month I'm doing 4 to 5 introductions for the app. It was originally pitched to me as their YouTube channel. So it goes live on their YouTube channel, their Instagram, and their other social networks. And then it would go live on my TikTok channel. And so we'd sort of cover all the bases. And then he said, I'm putting it in the app. And I was like, that's insane. So it was a shock when I first opened up Momitu and, like, there I am, you know, right under all these movies. It's a very surreal, cool feeling. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've been working together for the last couple months, and it's been great.
I love that. And that's one of my favorite things about tuning into any film, especially the classic films on TCM. Robert Osborne in the day.
Yeah.
And now Ben Mankiewicz, I believe, is doing the introductions now.
Yeah, they've got a series of hosts. So there's Ben Mankiewicz, there's Alicia Malone, there's Dave Karger, who does a lot of the musicals and that kind of those kinds of films. There's Eddie Muller, who hosts Noir Alley and all the film noir stuff. And there's a woman whose name escapes me because I don't catch the channel as much as I used to, but she does all the Silent Sunday stuff. So all the silent film stuff on the channel, that's her. And so, yeah, they've got a whole series of hosts. Because, for about 10 years, it was just Robert Osborne doing these films, these introductions.
Yeah, that was always interesting to me because there's always that little bit of backstory that, you know, you're not going to get from watching the film. So it's always kind of fun to see and hear a little bit about the behind the scenes. And that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed doing this show is it's forced me to go and research a little bit to see if there is any history, you know, and if not history of the actual film that I can find, then some of the history of the actors or the directors or whoever involved in the making of the film. And that's been fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I think it's important, you know, my biggest love of Turner Classic Movies and those introductions is the context they put these films in. You know, for a lot of classic films, they are problematic, and there's a lot of stuff in those films that needs to be set within a context, so you're not going in blind. And these introductions help set that up. And mind you, you've got 2 minutes to give some backstory on the making of these films. It's not a full blown lecture, you know, like you would get in a college class, but it's enough, I think, to sort of set the stage and prepare you to understand what you're about to watch. And a lot of times those introductions and just knowing what went on during the making of those films can give you such a deeper appreciation for the film itself. You know, a lot of content creators, you know, they're on the younger side and they look at old black and white movies and they say they're boring or they, you know, it's too slow, I don't like this. Or they just they write off, you know, a lot of these beloved films like Citizen Kane and Casablanca as overrated, and I hate that word. You know, these films were classics for a reason. These are beloved for a reason. And Casablanca is the perfect example of a film that deserves the context and should be studied because that film is lightning in a bottle. There was talk, I want to say, around late 90s, early 2000s, that they were going to remake Casablanca with Josh Hartnett in the bogey role. And I'm wearing my bogey t-shirt today. And I was like, that's a dumb idea. And it's a dumb idea for a lot of reasons, but mostly because that film is a snapshot of World War II in a way that I don't think any other film really is. Because if you, especially the scene, the La Marseillaise scene, where everyone gets up and sings, the German soldiers are singing their anthem, and the rest of the cafe is singing La Marseillaise, and they're sort of challenging each other. Almost all the extras in that scene are European refugees from the war. And they had come over to America through various channels. And the blonde woman who's crying during the scene, Madeleine LeBeau, had fled Paris just before Germany invaded with her husband. And they made their way, I think, through South America and Canada and like all over. And they finally settled in Los Angeles. And she was in the movie. And so the tears on her face are tears of pride and loss and just all of these emotions flooding her. And there's no way in hell can you capture that emotion and all of that in a remake of any kind.
No.
And I think understanding what went into the making of that film, how, you know, it was basically done on the fly. The script is being rewritten every day or written every day. The actors themselves, Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, and I want to say, I can't remember if it was Paul Henreid or Claude Rains, but I think it was Claude Rains. They had wanted out. They didn't want to do the film. Like, they realized, like, this is going to ruin us. This is terrible. This is boring. No one's going to sit through this. And they stuck it out, and it ended up becoming a huge hit and a classic and all that. But, like, at the time, they were trying to get out of their contract. They didn't want to do it. It's unbelievable how everything that could have gone wrong sort of did go wrong, and it ended up becoming lightning in a bottle.
That's astonishing. And you're telling that story about the singing and everything and who was actually doing the singing. I went chills, just kind of went down my spine when I just think about that. And yeah, you wouldn't be able to recreate that today. Today's audiences, I think, are also too far removed from the event. I think it would be, you'd have to like have almost a history lesson beforehand in some cases for some people to really truly understand what was going on. Or you have to try to like change it into something more modern, and I'm not sure how you would do that.
I think the focus of society is so different today than it was back then. What we value and what we focus on, and by a result, what we then focus the camera on, is just very, very different.
Right. And, you know, there are so many films that are viewed today through a modern lens, and we should view classic films to a degree through a modern lens to understand why they were problematic and, you know, the politics of everything going on. One of my like, the thing I beat the drum most on my channel is art is political, inherently political. There's no way around it. We are a political society. We are a political species. It affects everything we do. There's this great story of, like, there was a guy who was on his way into New York City on September 11th, and the towers come down, and he was on his way to a job interview, and he turned around and decided, you know, I want to live my life. Life's too short. And so he starts up My Chemical Romance. He was the lead singer of My Chemical Romance. And so this woman who's writing this book series is listening to a ton of My Chemical Romance.
It's
Twilight, exactly. Yeah. And then Twilight goes on to influence and inspire Fifty Shades of Grey, because it was Twilight fan fiction. So because of 9/11, we have Fifty Shades of Grey. And it's this weird through line of history. But, like, every decision, you know, there are these eras of, like, pre-World War II, post-World War II, pre-9/11, post-9/11. Television in, you know, the early 2000s, after 9/11, was almost entirely, like, patriotic, yay America, mm-hmm. you know, shows about terrorists and terrorism, 24. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were an actor of color, specifically if you were, you know, of Middle Eastern descent, basically if you were a non-white person, your role choices were pretty limited at the time. You know, you were basically playing a terrorist for a long period of time. And it's just, you know, politics has influenced everything that has gone on. And so we need to view these films through that lens. And you know, you take a film like Gone with the Wind, which is often cited as, you know, a film that is past its prime. It shouldn't, it's irrelevant. It's all this. It's not, though. It's a historical document. It is a look at the country in the 1930s and before, if you look at the book, of, you know, this is what a lot of the southern states believed, that the North was responsible for the war and for the decimation of the economy in the South. Reconstruction apologia. It's, you know, all of this stuff. And this is where stuff like Turner Classic Movies and my channel come in, is to provide that context and that history. You know, going in to a movie like that blind and not knowing the history about it will most likely affect you if you are aware of everything that's wrong with that film. But if you go in knowing, you know, this is what Margaret Mitchell thought, this is what, you know, a lot of the, you know, the people behind this thing thought, this is what, you know, this movie was sort of made with people who didn't believe all of this, but they were just trying to make a good movie. It's just, there's so many moving pieces going on.
I think that's the most important thing about some of these classic films, especially when you go back into the 40s and the 30s and everything, is the snapshot quality of what life was like. You know, they are portraying, right, especially if it's not any kind of a period piece, if it's supposedly a modern film, this is what people were wearing. This is what people were doing. Even if it's just something real simple about just the mannerisms of the time. I was blown away once we watched a film, and I'm blanking on which film it was. Maybe Lydia can help me. There was a scene where someone he wanted to just use hand gestures to let people know that he was going to go make a phone call. And we're so used to going like this with the thumb and the finger, you know, right, phone call. Well, he did, you know, the candlestick phone thing where he puts one like a fist to his ear and then a fist to his, that blew me away. And I think that, well, of course that's what he would do.
Right.
But it's sort of like kids today don't understand why the save icon is a disc, because they've never used one before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We looked up, we ran across where there have been jokes in movies that neither of us understood. And I, on a whim, would just look up what had happened, like the top headlines at the time. And there was a lady in Canada that had had sextuplets. And so, you know, and Bob Hope is here giving a joke about something about, six kids or something. And today we don't understand that. But at that time, when we didn't have the kind of medical technology that we have today, and that's still incredibly remarkable, but people in that day would have been watching that and laughing their heads off going, oh, right. This is because of the lady in Canada. So that's so much fun to me, is running across the external history. You and Christopher are so great, I think, at looking at the film history of it. And I like to dive outside of that and see, well, what's the context of the people making these movies at the time. The context of the film is, this is where we are in time. This is the style. This is the way people speak. But what's going on around that that's influencing those things as well? It's a lot of fun to look at. And usually you run into something that I learned something. It's amazing to me the amount of history that we've lost by just not being able to retain it. And you're exactly right. All the context of this, it's impossible for us to really capture without even with deep diving into it. It's just impossible for us to get every nuance and innuendo, just like you guys were just saying, kids today don't get the save disc. And that's not that far removed. Instead of just 10 years, we're talking 50, 60, 70 years. Yeah. And it's so valuable to understand that, and also such a challenge to keep up with it. Because even what we're creating here today is gonna eventually be replaced by something else, fall by the wayside. Somebody else will come in and rediscover everything that we've talked about. Hopefully somebody comes back and finds it all. But we don't have that guarantee, so I guess we're all just doing what we can here.
Yeah, there was a sketch comedy show. I cannot remember if it was Mad TV or the Whitest Kids You Know. One of those sketch comedy shows, and they did a bit. It was sort of a parody of the History Channel, set like 300 years in the future, and they uncover these ancient relics, these records of this musical group called the Beatles, and they, you know, they're going through, and it's poking fun at like these talking heads on these history shows that are just sort of making it up as they go along. And so they say, you know, the Beatles were a group comprised of Paul McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Scottie Pippen. And that's like, they've amassed this like conglomeration of facts that don't match up quite well, but like they're interpreting them a certain way. And like, if we're not careful, that's going to be us, you know, 100 years from now.
Yeah.
And like
the greatest composition in the world was Britney Spears' Toxic, you know, exactly, and it's showing up on a jukebox in 4 million years in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. There was that film Rain of Fire, the Christian Bale dragon movie. And I remember distinctly one scene where, you know, years had passed since the dragons took over, and they're recreating Star Wars for these kids in live theater. And it's just, it's wild to me. Like we will get to that at a certain point. Like something's going to wipe out the planet, and we're going to have to reenact Star Wars and all these films for people, because like no one's going to be around to have remembered them.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons, it's become one of the reasons that I think that Lydia and I have now done this show for 12 years. Granted, I mean, we only do one show a month, so it's not like we have, you know, a ton of shows, but still.
Over 100 shows.
It's a lot of shows.
It is.
But it is, in a way, kind of our effort to keep some of these films alive. They're public domain. We try to host them on our YouTube channel. We talk about them on our podcast. If I find them elsewhere on some streaming service or another, I'll try to watch them there just to like give them that one hit a year that they might get or something, just to keep them around. So hopefully someone else will also stumble across this film that is hopefully, you know, worth watching. And there are a few films that Lydia and I have watched that went, you know, if it disappeared tomorrow, will the world be a worse off place? Maybe not. You know, but we've come across a few where, like, my God, people have to watch this film. This is one of the, this is one of the best films. Why have I not heard about this film until now? And so, that's definitely something that we, I guess, in our small way, are trying to do, just to keep the history alive, keep these films alive, and they deserve to be seen. Even not so great ones, I feel like they deserve to be seen still.
Well, when you consider that 90-95% of films ever made have been lost, that, you know, between nitrate being destroyed or going up in flame, you know, just things not being taken care of. MGM famously was not taking care of its old films, because, you know, back in the day, if you if you ran a movie studio, you know, this is pre-VHS, pre-Betamax, pre-DVD. You know, once a movie was out of theaters and it was put on a shelf, that was it. No one saw it again unless you wanted to re-release it, in, you know, in 10 years like they did with Wizard of Oz. But for the most part, it went on a shelf and no one thought about it. And it wasn't until the 60s when a lawyer, I think his last name was Mayer, but he wasn't related to them. He had come to MGM and he said, "Your history, your future is in your back catalog. And if you don't take care of these films, you're going to lose everything." And lo and behold, 1965, one of the hangars in, or the bunkers at MGM Studios goes up in flames. A ton of films are lost. I want to say that was where they were keeping, it was a Lon Chaney film about Jack the Ripper.
Oh, yeah, I know which one you're talking about, and I'm blanking it. Something at Midnight or...
Yeah, it's something like that. And it was
London
like the
After
only copy.
Midnight. Is it London After
London
Midnight?
London After Midnight. I think that's where London After Midnight was being kept. The only copy left in existence, and it's gone forever. You know, and so after that, he really started transferring everything to safety film, 35mm, to keep it. You know, it didn't degrade nearly as quickly as nitrate. It wasn't as flammable as nitrate. Everything was going to be kept on. And going forward, other studios started doing the same. And then once home video hit it, it was like, we've got this whole back catalog, we can make more money, all this stuff. Like, it's so important. It's why I push physical media so much, and why I work for Momitu, or I'm working with Momitu, so I don't hate streaming, but I hate that everything is going to streaming only, and we are losing that physical connection to our media, because I don't know about you, but like, when I want to watch a movie, I really hate having to go through 8 different streaming apps to try and find it. Or wondering who's got it this month and then who's going to get it next month. But I know, you can't see it here, but I've got a shelf of classic films behind me that I know I can always reach in and put on whatever I want. And I see things like Sony just announced their new PlayStation 5 Pro, and this thing doesn't have a disc drive in it. Mm-hmm. And I know that if you're a 4K movie watcher, a lot of 4K movie watchers use their PS5 to watch 4K films. They're not going to have that disc drive in there anymore. Our movie studio is going to be rushing to put things out on 4K for people to watch if, you know, millions of people now no longer have a way to watch 4K discs. It's just I have this really nervous feeling about what's going to happen to the future of film and the future of art, of historical film, because I feel like we're going to get to a point where studios and companies are going to throw their hands up and say, we're done, and it's just not lucrative for us anymore. It's not worth it.
Yeah, I am definitely a proponent of physical media. I do enjoy having that DVD or Blu-ray or CD at my disposal, because I have friends that I'll go on social media and they'll rant and rave because the movie that they bought has just been taken down off the, you know, Amazon that they purchased. And I'm like, well, you didn't actually buy it, did you? You just effectively had it on extended loan. I've got a copy here if you want to come over and watch it.
Right.
I'm the same way. Even with a lot of my music, when I bought my most recent car, it didn't even occur to me that it wouldn't have one. I go to get in my brand new car and I've got my little zipper thing of CDs and I go and I don't have a CD player.
Yeah.
It didn't even occur to me. Didn't even occur to me to even look when I bought the car. And so like, oh, well, I gotta do a few different things now.
You know? Yeah, it's aftermarket, and I think you can buy a separate disc drive for the PlayStation, which is fine. But like, that's an extra $80 expense. I don't think most people are going to use if they're streaming only. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, you can't stream in 4K or these high end formats because your internet isn't up to snuff, or the service is charging extra money to do that. I know if you want to stream 4K at max. You know, the HBO app, you need to pay another, like, it's $20 a month to do that versus 15 or 10. It's just they make it harder and harder for you to get better quality stuff. And then a lot of companies like Disney aren't putting things out on physical disc at all. And so if they get, you know, there was that Willow series they released that they just took off completely, didn't release it in physical, and it's gone forever. There's just, there's no way to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't advocate for piracy, in a lot of instances, because I'm a writer, I don't want people pirating my books. As much as I don't love the copyright system, it's all we have that makes sure we can have a living off of our work. But I do support people saving things for posterity if they're about to be lost. And, you know, there are plenty of films from the 20s and 30s and even before then that might have been lost had it not been for something like the Internet Archive or someone's Plex server. It's unfortunately, you know, you occasionally have to resort to nefarious is not the word I'm looking for, but it's all I can think of. Uncouth means to secure the future of this medium because there's no one else is doing it.
No, absolutely. I mean, the films, there's many classic films, like you said, that would have been lost if not for someone with a VHS player that someone took the piece of tape and covered over, you know, the little thing so they could record off something or whatever.
Yeah.
50 years from now, it's going to be the same way. Someone's going to say, you know, oh, well, we'll never see that Avengers Endgame or something again. And someone will go, well, I might have a copy.
Yeah. Right.
It reminds me of there was a lady in the 70s, Marion Stokes, I think was her name, that recorded on like 6 TVs 24 hours a day.
Yes.
And now archive.org has this massive repository of date of TV programs, of news, of all kinds of different things that happened during that period of time, that because she just obsessively tape recorded things, video recorded things. And we don't have anything like, I'm not aware of anybody doing that these days. And like you said, Harry, people now would call that piracy, right? Now there's this huge deal. Oh, you can't record anything. You can't tape anything. But you're exactly right. If somebody's not doing that, how is this getting recorded for posterity? And then who owns that once it is done? Who right. is actually taking care of that? There's not a national trust for all video ever created, for all film or entertainment ever created.
I remember that story, Lydia. I think I actually saw a little documentary or something about her. And yeah, because she was constantly recording all this stuff, there's a lot of live programming that wasn't saved, that wasn't recorded, that she did have, that we now have access to and everything. But just like Lydia was saying too, does, you know, the studio, does the television network or whatever, do they own it? They didn't care. They didn't save it. They just broadcast it and walked away. So why can you claim that if you gave it away, you know, 30 years ago?
Or
overwrote it if you did save it at all, and then you decided, oh, we just erased it because we needed room for something else.
It's amazing how much has been lost television wise like how many Tonight shows with Johnny Carson that are just lost forever because they were taped over or tossed out. You know, and then the previous host of the Tonight Show,
Parr.
There's Parr, and then wasn't Steve Allen? Didn't he host? Like, those are gone. You know, they didn't think to keep that stuff, and that extends to a lot of the film and television industry. You know, you think about props and costumes and sets and things. You know, famously the Seinfeld episode where where Kramer gets the old Merv Griffin show set and rebuilds it in his apartment. You know, but that's not entirely far off from what they would do. You know, MGM famously 1970 sells off a ton of stuff from their archives, and you know, luckily Debbie Reynolds is there to buy up a lot of it. But they didn't care. You know, they made this stuff to be used and reused and reused until it didn't work anymore, or it was frayed around the edges, and they would throw it out and get something new or build something new. Like, there was no sense of history in these studios. Everything was just working fodder, and when it was done, it was done, and it was tossed away.
There's a website, and I can't think of it right now. It's to do with dresses, but I think it's Costume Frocks or Frock Flicks or something like that. I apologize for not knowing it. Mm-hmm. But they will go through and identify costumes used in historic films and then reused in other historic films. And you can see it's the same dress. Oh, they added a bow here. They added trim there. Oh, they reworked this to be a different era entirely. And it's a lot of fun to see. But the result, of course, is that those costumes get used and reused until they're eventually destroyed, which is fine because it's being used to make the art. But we just don't even think about just the masses of just stuff that's just gone. That got used until, like you said, it got broken or thrown away. Or stolen, and, I mean, or taken home by the actor.
They physically destroyed, so like they deliberately destroyed so many things. Going back to Gone with the Wind, you know, a lot of people who watch the movie don't realize the burning of Atlantis scene was the destruction of the old King Kong sets, from 1933, and some old Cecil B. DeMille sets from King of Kings. You know, they burned those to make room to build Tara and, you know, other sets around the lot because they were running out of room. DeMille himself destroyed his original Ten Commandments set from 1922, 23. He had built it along the California coastline, and he didn't want anyone else using it. So when the shooting was done, he destroyed the whole thing and buried it under the sand. There had been a recovery project done, I want to say 10, 15 years ago, to try and salvage whatever they could from the original set and bring it back to life, so to speak, you know, put it in a museum or do something with it. They ran out of funding, but they found some big, like, Sphinx pieces and wall sections that he had left behind that had been buried under the sand for 100 years.
It is so odd what some things get destroyed and lost, what some things get saved. I remember historically, one of the great stories I love is the time machine from the 1960 time machine.
Yes.
I think it ends up in a gas station somewhere, broken and just in a corner of a gas station. Why? But then something, and luckily, like all the equipment in the original Frankenstein, Strickfaden's laboratory equipment.
Yeah.
That survives. And that actually gets used in subsequent Frankenstein films and then like in Young Frankenstein.
In Young Frankenstein, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just, of all the things that survive, why would something like that looks like it's just a piece of this and a piece of that, and we put it over here. You think something like that would get broken up and split around and spread to this studio or this prop house or something? And no, it ends up in someone's garage, and then someone says, yeah, you can use that again.
It makes you wonder if the things that don't get preserved are the things that are so random and off the wall that they can't be reused. How often do they make movies about time machines? How often do they make movies about Frankenstein? It doesn't come along very often.
Well, they would repurpose stuff you wouldn't even think of that they would repurpose. For example, the house that Jimmy Stewart lives in Harvey, the front of that house was taken apart and it was transplanted to somewhere else on the lot and used to create the facade of the Bates home in Psycho. So if you look at the Psycho house, it is part Harvey house.
Oh, which is one of the greatest movies ever.
Yeah, exactly. But they did that all the time. And one of my favorite stories is, like, I want to say 15, 20 years ago, there was a show on the Sci-Fi Channel called Hollywood Treasure. And it was it would follow the exploits of, can't remember his name, but he ran Profiles in History, which is an auction house. And they would auction off memorabilia and props and stuff. And he goes to this guy's junkyard. And up in the trees on this junkyard, nestled around two or three trees, just like a treehouse, is a giant shark. It is a giant maquette shark, great white. And he's like, and what they find out is this is the last, from the original mold, this is the last Bruce the Shark from Jaws that exists in the world. And this guy refuses to sell this thing. He's like, I know what I have. I love it. He had made like cardboard teeth to put in its mouth to bring it back to life, so to speak. But it became like the mascot for this guy's junkyard. I don't know what happened in the last 20 years. I don't know if he died, if he retired, but at some point he got rid of the shark. And that's what's hanging in the Academy Museum as you go up the escalator, is that Bruce the Shark. They restored it. I want to say, I can't remember if it was Frank Darabont or, I think it was Frank Darabont who sort of oversaw the restoration. But that Bruce that's hanging over the escalator going up to the second floor of the Academy Museum was that original shark. And it's the last surviving model of Bruce that exists.
That's awesome.
It's wild. Like, there's the story of the original Death Star from Star Wars that ended up in some guy's house for like 30 years, and he didn't even know. Like, he knew what it was, but it was just like this thing that they kept putting garbage in and stuff, and it ended up in an antique store at some point. The carpet bag that Mary Poppins carried in the film was a gift, or it was a prize in a sweepstakes contest in like the 70s. After the film, and it was in someone's basement or in their attic for like 30, 40 years until it was finally discovered and they realized what they had was the prop from the movie. It's just wild that these things are just not discarded, but just sort of tucked away somewhere. And you don't realize. I'm a firm believer. I take the Indiana Jones approach. It belongs in a museum. You know, I can't remember if it was Prop Store or Heritage. One of the big auction houses recently just auctioned off, the, I think it's a Givenchy dress from Sabrina that Audrey Hepburn wears. And it is absolutely stunning. Even in pictures, like, it just pops off the screen. All this intricate lace work and these details and stuff. And something like that, I don't know where it ended up, but I really hope it ended up at the Academy Museum or some other museum, because that should be seen by everybody. I hate knowing that these iconic pieces are in some private collection that... You know, you don't know if he bought it because he just needed it and, you know, wanted it for whatever, and it's in some archive, or if he really loves the film. But, like, that should be enjoyed by everyone imaginable.
Look at my cosplay.
Or if his teenage daughter really wanted something vintage to wear to prom and to get to prom. Like,
like when they put, was it Kim Kardashian in an old Marilyn Monroe dress or something? Like, they put her in one of the old Hollywood dresses. It's like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. Example, and I think this is where it's a little bit hopeful. So, you know, Doctor Who is one of the best known series that has huge missing chunks out of it, and there are people going out of their way to try and recreate it, to animate it where there's no video available. And I think there's interest in that. You know, obviously we, our podcast and your program exist for that, for a reason, because there is interest. If there is no interest, we'd probably eventually give up, even though definitely for Christopher and me, it's something we enjoy doing, not because we think we're going to get rich off of it ever or anything like that. But there is interest from people that really want to preserve that. And I think that'll continue going forward. It blows my mind that today my nephews, who are about college age now, just about, just think the 80s are the coolest thing ever. Like, they just, the 80s are, like, so rad. They don't say rad.
Thanks, Stranger Things.
And, you know, we think of, like, the 50s and the 60s, maybe the 40s that way, and they're thinking that way about the 80s. But I think that'll continue back to, you know, Christopher and I end up eventually watching movies from the 1920s, and that interest will expand for those younger people also.
Yeah, there's that Woody Allen film, Midnight in Paris. It's one of my favorite movies. And
that is a great film.
It's such a great film. It's a beautiful film. And what I love is that toward the end there's that speech that not so much a speech, but it's just this conversation that Owen Wilson's having with Marion Cotillard. And basically, you know, he realizes, like, everyone has a nostalgia for a time period they didn't live in. You know, for him, it was the 1920s. For her, it was the La Belle Époque. So there were all these time periods that they never lived in, that they don't really understand the politics of and the history of, that they see this, you know, the shimmer on it. Because that's, the, you know, he grew up reading the books and he grew up, you know, with this idea of what the roaring 20s were like. And it's so much different than what he, you know, actually experienced. And I feel like we have a lot of that. Like, I would love to go back to the 40s. Would I? Probably not. You know, I love modern medicine and my iPhone and, you know, the internet and all that.
Oh, gosh, who wants to be in the middle of an actual world war?
Right, like, exactly.
That's horrific. But the movies from that time are enchanting.
Exactly. You know, I'd love to see the studio system of that time. And, you know, when it was so much easier to just set up shop and make movies as opposed to, like, who you know. And
without $100 million. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. No, I would love to go back and be a part of some of the Poverty Row studios. Because they are what now I'm a big fan of, like, independent film. Even though there are many that I'll watch and go, that was terrible, you know, but it's still a fact that someone had a vision. They got their friends and family together, maybe, or they were able to hire somebody, and damn it, they made a film. You know, I can't say that, you know, someone made a film, and now that film is available for viewing. That's how I look at, like, some of the Poverty Row studios back in the 20s and 30s. Is it's just people with shoestrings and bubble gum. And and a passion, or just, I need to put food on the table, and they told me if I can hold the camera, I can work. You know, that's it. And those are the movies. Those are some of the most fun movies to sit there and watch, because, yes, that is definitely a plywood brick wall, or or that is a rubber octopus or whatever, you know. And it's just, it's so much fun to watch them, and you can't help but just sort of smile at the audacity that sometimes that these filmmakers had, because they had to have known no one's going to buy this, but roll film.
Exactly. Well,
and they had less to compare it to.
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking back through over 100 years of history.
That's true.
And they are
very big lens that we have.
Their contemporary time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it would have been fascinating and amazing. Sorry, Harry. I didn't mean to get you off guard. No, that's all right.
You know, going back to what you're saying about, you know, the Poverty Row studios and just like being able to make a movie. Frank Capra got his start by literally calling up one of those studios and, you know, answering an ad looking for a director. And he's like, yeah, I can do it. He had no experience directing major films. He was like, sure, whatever. I can do the job. And they
gave him
the job.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and then he gets in and he becomes Frank Capra and, you know, he goes off to war and records all that and does It's a Wonderful Life. But it's like, and same thing with John Ford. John Ford's brother, Francis Ford, was a vaudevillian and an actor and got his brother in at the ground level and, you know, was an extra on set and was doing all these different little acting roles and then eventually works his way up to becoming a director and becomes John Ford. And, you know, it's just, even back then it was who you know, but like there was sort of the path was either you work your way up or you just call up and fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, even many of the big directors and everything that we know that are working today or have just maybe recently they're in their twilight of their career or whatever, got their starts with the B movies of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
They were part of like the Roger Corman stable, James Cameron, Francis Ford Coppola. They all got their starts under someone like Corman or someone like that, just doing, we need someone to hold this. Great. Hey, do you want to direct the next film? Sure.
Yeah. Michael Keaton worked on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yeah.
As like a grip or something. Like he was the one pushing the trolley through the tunnel. It's like, oh, it's Michael Keaton.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love that. And it's one of the reasons why I love the independent films is because I'm feeling like you have no idea who I'm watching. I could be watching the next greatest filmmaker, mm-hmm. you know, in the earliest stages of their careers, even if they're not directing, maybe they're the cameraman, maybe they're the person on screen, you know, you don't know, but you just have no idea where the next great somebody is going to come from.
Exactly. And, you know, to some degree, as much as I lament the streaming age and just the push to digitize everything and not own anything, the access to classic films that people have now is unprecedented. It used to be Turner Classic Movies or your local art house or your local Blockbuster, whatever they had in stock. And now you can watch pretty much whatever you want on the internet by any means necessary. And that's incredible. And now you also have access to all these scripts. You know, you can go to a Barnes & Noble and get a script for a major motion picture, or you can go online. Someone's uploaded the script somewhere. You know, the availability of information to new or current and up-and-coming filmmakers is just so different from what it was even 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's so much more vast. And, you know, I won't say you won't need film school, but like you can get film school very easily just searching the internet.
Well, our podcast, Orphan Entertainment, wouldn't exist if not for the easy availability of many of the films because they're on the streaming services or because they're someone uploaded them to YouTube or Vimeo or what have you. And it's we're very thankful that someone took the time to take some old VHS tape or some old 35 millimeter film that they had lying around or they found in their father's shoebox or something like that and decided to digitize it and upload it. And, you know, they're the saints
of the genres. The democratization of technology. I mean, you used to have to rent a camera. You know, you hear the stories of Kevin Smith making Clerks and he had to rent the camera every day and you know, he had $25,000 to work on. And now I can record a movie on my iPhone in 4K and edit it on my computer and upload it and have it watched by millions of people. And it's so much different now.
Yeah, very much.
And it's running into the same issue that every other form of media is running into. The result is you have some really great things coming out and some not so great things coming out. But I think we forget that that's true of any era of film. There were some really great things out of the 20s. There were some really not great things out of the 20s.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Every era in between then and now. Well, and that's why we have things like, you know, the comedy shows. I'm not sure how much, if I can say them or not, but the guys that rip on the movies, which we love watching, they're so much fun. If you didn't have things that came out like Birdemic, like some of the horrible movies that, you know, or I hate to say horrible, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I should have said some of the unconventional movies that we aren't usually used to seeing. Then you wouldn't have, it's a whole different type of entertainment coming out of just that. So it's so much fun to see. I think you're going to have high quality and low quality production whether it's all streaming, whether it's big studios, whether it's independent. And that's what we discover that's fun. That's the fun part of it, is sometimes you're surprised. You get a silent film like Beau Geste and just go, oh my goodness, this is amazing, which was a love project by somebody who put the original music together and then posted it on YouTube. And so we get this great product that's apparently seemingly very accurate to the original release, but we don't get that on most silent films. Imagine if we did the original score with these old mm-hmm. silent films and getting to see it the way that the directors imagined it. They'd be phenomenal. They'd be, I think, probably so much better than what we have as a product now. But thank goodness we have that product now, because without that, we wouldn't even know that some of these are great, even without the amazing music and cues and all of those. And I think that's going to continue into the future. We're going to have that wide strata of very well done and less well done, less skillfully done films, and the things that get remembered are the things that people, individuals, choose to conserve.
You know, it's always been that way, that studios have created, you know, B-movie garbage on top of the A-list stuff. And during the studio system days, you know, before the Paramount decrees abolished the practice of owning theaters as well as the means of production, you know, they would sort of stick it to smaller theaters by saying, sure, you can get our A-list film, but you also have to take all of this crap behind it that we made. You know, all the, you know, these five or six films that no one wanted to see, if you want, you know, Casablanca or Gone with the Wind or whatever, you now have to get these six or seven other films that don't really, no one's going to pay to see. And, you know, it's, I can't say things have gotten better, because like you said, democratization of technology has made it so anybody can make a movie. But I feel like there's less of a push to make schlock, because I think that, especially nowadays with streaming, the idea is you want people to watch. You want people to sign on or subscribe to your streaming service to watch your stuff. And so there's more of an effort, if not to make better quality content, at least make compelling content that will keep people glued to their seats.
That is something I hadn't really thought of, is that, yeah, we are kind of losing, we've lost the sort of sci-fi used to do, like
the made
Friday
for sci-fi
Saturday
films.
Night.
Oh, oh yeah, I love
original
those.
Film. The Titanoboas and the, yeah.
Yeah, they're a little cheesy, a little BBC production or early BBC production, but so much fun for story. The storylines were so great.
But we are kind of losing a little bit of that, because it's no longer, there's not that sort of, you know, we're going to make it, we're going to make a, another a movie about a shark bat. Yeah, shark bat. That's it. People are kind of, I think, losing a little bit of the, it's lost its luster, I suppose, or something. And yeah, now you want people to come to your service or whatever. You can't just have that.
It's the same thing. We were just talking about it downstairs, that it's running into the same thing with publishing or with film or with music or anything else. Studios, the entities, the corporations that have a lot of money are focused on the things that are going to make a lot of money. They aren't interested in a lot of things that'll make a little money each. They want one thing that's going to make it super, super big. And that's across all forms of media at this point. Mm-hmm. And so not having, or maybe, and I think in 10 years we'll look back and say, oh, well, those independent filmmakers or those small budget studios became the streaming services, or they became this indie house, or they became this group of filmmakers that maybe haven't even evolved yet. But they, I think that what we're going to run into is that I don't want to make predictions, but what we're probably going to see is that people that are making short format film now, and instead of us seeing them as being, you know, the B films of the past, we're going to see, oh, it was this creator on this platform, and then they went and they started making these films.
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing that now with YouTube shorts, or not YouTube shorts, but short films on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You know, Lights Out, for example, the horror film that came out several years ago, was based on this short YouTube film that creeped the hell out of everybody. You know, I think the whole thing is like 8 minutes long, if that. And they turned it into a full feature film. And honestly, I've seen some of the best horror in short films on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. There's just been some good dramas too. Surprisingly good.
Yeah. It's incredible when you give people, you know, a limited budget and a limited amount of time and a short runtime window. Because, you know, if you're uploading it to YouTube, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to make it more than 15 minutes because you want people to sit and watch it.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot you can do with those kinds of limitations. Look at Jaws. You know, the shark didn't work half the time, and we got a better movie because of it.
Yeah.
When you put those limitations, whether forced or otherwise, on a filmmaker, you can get some really compelling, incredible content as a result.
Because they have to be creative. They don't have the luxury to say, we'll fix it in post. They have to fix it now.
Or we'll CGI the hell out of it later. Like, it's yes. so much better when there are those limitations. I love...
And they have to be creative.
Yeah. You know, we've been hearing great things about the new Beetlejuice movie that came out. And I hear a lot of it is because they didn't rely on CGI. They went back to stop motion and to sort of match the style of the original. But that also limits what you're able to do on screen. But I think it's fantastic because we get a better told story because of it, and we get a more tangible story for the actors on screen.
And the reactions now when somebody does practical effects. There was a movie that came out recently. I can't even remember what it was, but I remember somebody saying, oh yeah, it's all done with, it was one of the Alien films recently, and there were a ton of practical effects.
Oh, Romulus,
yeah. Yeah, and it was, whether or not the story was that good, and we'll just leave that hanging out there, the effects were good, and people wanted to see it because you can tell if it's CG or not. You know, we know, our eyes aren't intelligent enough, our brains are intelligent enough to be able to tell the difference. And there's a place for CG, and there's a place for advanced technology, and there's a place for AI, but when you force people to solve problems creatively, the product is always better than if you just throw more money at it.
Right. Now, Spielberg figured that out early on with Jaws and then Jurassic Park. There's 9 minutes of CGI in Jurassic Park because it was a literally brand new technology. A lot of it was sort of created for the film, and he didn't want to overdo it and flood the audience with it. And we got a better movie because of that.
Much better. Much, much better.
I think people, whether they know it or not, are learning lessons of those early films, early 20th century films, because, of course, no one had the ability. Mm-hmm. There was no such thing as CGI or fixing it in post. There was very limited what you could do after you shot that film. So you had to be creative on set, in camera. And I think people are sort of relearning those lessons a little bit today. Yeah, you know, even if they're not going back and looking at these older films, you know, if they did, they maybe would learn the lesson a little sooner.
The techniques, yeah.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with Spielberg who was saying how, you know, it's great that up and coming directors are watching my films or Nolan's films or Scorsese's films. And that's great and all, but you need to watch what we watched growing up, and you need to understand what we were studying, you know, when we were learning to direct films, because a lot of what we put in our films came from what came before. And, you know, you look at Lord of the Rings, I was talking about this on a live recently with a filmmaker, and I was going through how, like, I think it was the first Lord of the Rings, when they're going through, and I don't remember because I never read it. I don't pay attention to high fantasy stuff, but there's a scene where like the fellowship is walking through these caverns, and it's a forced perspective shot of, you know, they're this big, they're very tiny in this huge expansive cavern system. And they're using Peter Jackson is using the exact same filming technique that Fritz Lang was using on Metropolis to make small people appear on a big expansive, you know, cityscape. And there's like almost no CGI in it. It's literally forced perspective as they would have done in 1927. Mm-hmm. And he understood, like, to get the shot he needed, it wasn't throw more computers at it. It was go back to basics.
Yeah. Well, that's a lesson for us all. And on that note, I'm just kidding. We could probably end it there. It's a strong message.
Absolutely. But I don't think we can end at all until we hear a little bit more about Harry's grandfather.
Yes!
Oh, that's right. I forgot I dropped that nugget at the beginning.
Yes.
So my grandfather was Harry Noble Jr., and he was a songwriter. He performed with a his singing partner for a long time, and they he wrote the song "Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me," which was a big hit in 1964 by Mel Carter. But in 1944, he had a small part in a film called Step Lively, starring Frank Sinatra. And if you go back and watch the film, there's a part in the movie where it's all centered around a play is being staged, and I don't remember the exact plot of it. It's been a while since I've seen it. But they don't love like the quality of the show that's being written. And my grandfather is playing the role of father, and his singing partner is playing the role of mother. And there's a bunch of daughters in there as well. And they're rehearsing this play. And it's trite. It's very just terribly written on purpose. And his acting is very over the top, very like old style 1920s theater acting. But it's just very cool. Like, that's my grandfather right there, you know, in a movie. And Frank Sinatra's like 10 feet away.
That's awesome. Gosh, yeah. Well, don't even know where to go from there. Maybe we should probably come to bring this to a close. I don't want to take all your time, Harry. I don't know how much time you have available to us. We're coming up on an hour already of our discussion.
Whatever you want to talk about.
Really? If you have time, I wouldn't mind just jumping back into some early 20th century film and just, I'm curious, actually what I'm really curious is, where did your love for, was it your grandfather being in an older film that's kind of sent you down the path of kind of loving some of the older films, or was there anything else that took you where you are?
It was mostly my parents, who are still around. But growing up, I remember, you know, it was my parents and Turner Classic Movies, because it was always on in the house. You know, my mom was watching a musical, or my dad was watching a Marx Brothers film. And, you know, there was always a classic film playing in the house somewhere. And I just remember, you know, going from room to room, or, you know, whatever was going on, and hearing it in the background. And sometimes I would sit with my mom and we'd watch, like, you know, a Judy Garland film, or I'd sit with my dad and we'd watch a Humphrey Bogart film or something. And it was just those memories of it's the combination of spending that time with my folks and, you know, enjoying these films together. And it just instilled it's a comfort memory for me. You know, I go back and watch the old bumpers and the old, you know, TCM, you know, jingles and stuff that they would show between movies and some of the old programming and stuff. And it's that nostalgia for a better time for me. But it instilled a love of classic film in me. And then over time it became like the history and the making of these films. And I had wanted to be a filmmaker and a screenwriter early on. And I never got to do it. So I'm sort of, you know, living my dream now.
That's brilliant. And I know, Lydia, you kind of grew up watching some of those. You had a kind of a similar experience as Harry, didn't you? Wasn't it sort of a family?
Yeah, my family was, we'll call it very conservative. And so we were very limited on what we were allowed to watch. But we were always allowed to watch TCM and AMC at my dad's house. And so, and at some point we became movie recorders. Early 80s, whenever the VHS, you know, started allowing it, you know, we would I love this, record Brian Boitano at the Olympics figure skating.
Oh, wow.
That kind of thing. And so so at some point that translated into movies. And I think some of the first movies I remember watching much as a kid, we would record them, we'd tape them. And so we ended up, my dad had over 100 VHSs of classic movies that had been recorded off AMC and TCM, and we could go back and watch those. And when we would go to my dad's house, we would watch those, because that was the fun stuff to watch. It was unique. It was a movie we'd never seen before, and a lot of the time they were just loads of fun. And I'm with you guys, the introductions, anytime now that I watch a classic movie, I miss those introductions, because it was so much fun hearing about, you know, oh, Danny Kaye's his original name was David Daniel Kaminsky, and he had to dye his hair blonde because the studio told him that dark hair isn't funny, and the whole story about him supposed to have gotten his nose fixed and his reply to that. I loved those stories. And so I think Christopher brought me on board with Orphan Entertainment from the beginning, but it was his brainchild. And I'm so lucky that he did, because resulted in over 10 years of getting to look at all of these classic films that I may not have thought of otherwise. Certainly a lot that I wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise, but even more, I wouldn't necessarily have remembered, oh yeah, I can go back and watch black and white films. I can go back and watch movies from the 1940s, the 1930s, and I end up watching a lot more of them because I will follow a link off of the one that we're reviewing this week to watch a different one that looks like it'd be a lot of fun or has an actor, mm-hmm. an actress that I would love to see more of. So that's where mine came from, is pretty much identical to what you're talking about. It was just growing up with that. And then I think adding to that as I got older, finding a little bit of discontent with what's being made now. I'm not mm-hmm. really into a lot of modern movies because they don't speak much to me. And I am also a writer, and the genre that I write, it marries really, really well with classic film, but not so much with big budget superhero films. So so that's probably where I keep clinging to it.
I will say, it's so funny how adults think, you know, a movie's in black and white, it was made 70 years ago, it's got to be fine for kids, right? I was watching Night of the Hunter the other night, and my son walks in, and I'm like, you need to leave right now.
I love, one of my favorite examples is The Lady Eve. You go back and you rewatch that a couple of times, and you pay attention to the innuendo in that movie.
Oh, God.
And it's not appropriate for children, but then, you know, kids' TV shows today have a lot of inappropriate stuff in them that they say, oh, the kids don't understand it. I think they might, though.
There's, is it Horse Feathers? I think it's Horse Feathers. There's a scene where the three brothers are in the love interest's apartment, and this guy bursts through the door, and he's asking everybody, you know, who are you and why are you here? And he gets to Groucho, and Groucho says, oh, I'm the plumber. I'm here in case anything goes wrong with her pipes. That's the first time I've used that joke in 25 years. And it's like over yeah. a kid's head, but knowing now, it's like, holy crap, how did that get past the censors?
Absolutely. Yep.
I'm actually fairly a recent adapter or lover of some of these films. I actually started the show without really having an idea of what I was getting myself into. I think I mm-hmm. wanted, I knew some of the older films. I knew some of the classics. I knew Casablanca. I knew 12 Angry right. Men. And, you know, those were two of my favorite films. 12 Angry Men, I think, is probably one of my favorite films as far as acting. If you want to watch 12 people act, that's the movie I would point you to. So I knew some of those films. But anything older than that, I didn't know as much. I remember watching some Three Stooges shorts or something because they were on my local UHF station when the movie ran short or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I started this film because I kind of just started kind of poking around on things like YouTube or whatever. I'm like, wow, there's all these movies that are just there because they're old. And so I'm like, well, let's talk about them. Let's look at these films and let's actually talk about them. And that's why I started Orphan Entertainment. And so really most of the films that we've watched over the last 12 years, they're all first time watches for me. And they are eye opening almost in every film, because there's just the moments where it's either a line where you're just like, did he just say that? Or,
yeah.
Or, it's a particular, you know, it's 1927, and did that camera just like zoom and twirl? How in the world did they do that? You know, that sort of thing. It seemed for me, all of what we consider sort of the tropes of film in Hollywood now, I feel like I'm watching their origin story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you take a film like The Man Who Laughs, Conrad Veidt,
mm-hmm.
and you realize, oh, that's where the Joker came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where his design came from. Or I just did an intro a couple of weeks ago for Broken Arrow, 1950, starring Jimmy Stewart from Omitu. And, you know, I hadn't seen it before, and I'm watching it, and I'm doing the research, and you realize this film was a turning point for the Western as a genre, because pre-Broken Arrow, Westerns often painted Native Americans and indigenous peoples as the villains, as, quote, savages or, you know, uncivilized, and the you know, the white cowboys were there to settle the plains and all that. And Broken Arrow was the first, or among the first films, it was a revisionist Western, that painted the Native Americans in a more positive light and made them just as heroic as the cowboys and the quote settlers, you know, in a way that hadn't been done before. And so going back to our discussion on, you know, politics and film and, you know, understanding what goes into these films, you know, without that history, it's just another Western. But you, when you learn the backstory and what went into making it and, you know, the politics surrounding it, it adds a whole other layer and a whole other bit of texture to the viewing experience.
Yeah.
We just recently watched a Western that the entire story revolved around an unwed mother.
Oh, okay.
From Vengeance Valley.
Okay.
And she was portrayed as a sort of a strong, independent woman type. And we're thinking, that seems really progressive for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we just recently talked a little bit about a 1926 silent film, The Bat. And this silent film would be one of the inspirations for Bob Kane to create Batman.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so those are the things where we watch that those moments are the ones I love the most, where it's just you see something, the kernel of something that grows, or, you know, a film from the 30s that just seems way more progressive than you would expect from the 30s. And you begin wondering, is my image or my thought on the 30s completely wrong?
Right. Well, you know, pre 1936, it was the Wild West.
Yeah.
It was, you know, pre-code era was, they pretty much did whatever they wanted, which is why we ended up with the Hays Code in the first place. And, you know, this also goes back to lost film. So many films were recut to fit the code, and those pieces that were cut out were lost forever. There was a version of The Maltese Falcon done in, like, 1933, 34, that was recut post-code, and it's half the movie it was, literally half the movie it was back then, and we'll never get that back.
We just, on my my other podcast on Time Shifters, we just recently talked about Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein film. And I talked about how there was a line that was in the film, but then when it started going around to the state censors, and eventually I think the studio actually took it out, covered it with a clap of thunder, is when Henry Frankenstein, after he brings his creation to life, says, I know what it feels like to be God. And that was in the original film. And they went, okay, maybe that's too much. We got to cover that up. And it wasn't put back into the film. Fortunately, it still existed somewhere, somehow. But that wasn't actually put back into any release of the film until, I think, the 1980s.
Yeah, there was, Frankenstein is also the, there was another piece of that was lost for a long time. I'm looking it up because I can't remember the exact details, but it involves the scene where he meets the little girl and they're throwing flowers into the lake.
Yeah.
And it was so disturbing to audiences and censors that it was cut out until the 1980s when it was discovered again. But it bridges the gap between why the townsfolk, the villagers, go after him in the first place. Because it's not just that he killed her. It's that, you know, I'm reading here, the edited version actually makes the scene seem even worse in hindsight. Cutting out the part where Frankenstein's monster throws her in like a flower, that's what it was, and it's highly upset when she doesn't float, the tone of the sequence completely changes. So it for a long time, it just looks like he kills her out of nowhere, and they go after her, not realizing that he throws her in the flower because he believes she's going to float like a flower, because he's got this mind of a child. And, you know, without that context in there, it's a completely different film. It's a different scene.
Yep, but we actually talked about that very thing, because I mentioned that as well. And, you know, when you watch the film as you see it now, with the tossing into the water and everything, the Frankenstein's monster is a sympathetic character in the film.
Yeah.
You take that scene out of the movie. You cut the scene with him being visibly upset that something happened to this little girl, and you truly do kill him or turn him into just a bloodthirsty killer.
Right.
And it's only maybe 20 seconds of film, but those 20 seconds completely changes the tone of the movie.
Exactly.
It's astonishing. You know, the studios, they would make the films. This is, again, pre-code. And like I said, there would be state censor boards. So the film would travel And then Ohio would decide, no, can't have that. Pennsylvania can't have that. Wyoming, there's no way. And they chop and it's amazing we have any of these films in their entirety at all. And in some cases, we don't. Well, the films we have left are the films that are that were just kept, that were in the a back room somewhere in Rhode Island. You know, it's not the Hollywood print. It's the Rhode Island censor board print.
That's how we ended up with a complete version of Metropolis. Was for the longest time, when it came to the States, it was recut for American audiences. A lot of the really like heavy German expressionistic stuff was cut out of it, and American audiences got a much more abridged version of the film. It wasn't until 2008 when someone was digging through an old like cinema. I don't know if it was a theater or a museum of some kind. But they found this old cut of the film that had been preserved, and it was like 2 hours long. And there's like a whole other hour of footage that was thought lost forever because American theaters had cut it out and gotten rid of the footage. But in South America, they still had it. And now we have a much more complete, theatrically accurate version of Metropolis that we otherwise wouldn't have had.
Yeah, and I still haven't seen that final, like, full length cut yet. It's been that Blu-ray's been on my wish list for months, and I need to pull the trigger on it.
Same. I have the original on DVD. I gotta upgrade.
I had a version of the film on VHS, and it had like some sort of punk rock soundtrack or something to it. It was one of those, you know, we are of course big fans of public domain. You know, there we believe there is a time, and if it weren't for public domain, there would be a lot of even more films that would have been lost to us. But there is a dark side to the public domain that people can do whatever they want with a film.
Yeah.
I get to talk to Christopher about this kind of stuff once a month, and it's so much fun. Harry, I can only imagine you're doing your project by yourself, or I assume essentially by yourself. And so I hope that it's been fun for you to get to talk to other historical film nerds about... your passion project.
It's a lonely life, you know, being a classic film guy, especially on the internet or on TikTok, really, which is where I spend a lot of my time, because like I said, like horror talk is a whole community of people, and I'm sort of adjacent to it. I know a lot of the people in that community, but I don't play in their sandbox a lot, so you know, I'm not able to contribute. I'm not able to follow a lot of the stuff they watch. They watch some really just twisted stuff sometimes. You know, no one's watching Gene Kelly films with me. So, it's tough, you know, to find, but there's a small, cabal of classic film lovers who I pal around with, and, you know, we get together, you know, online every now and then and chat. But yeah, it's nice to talk to people about, you know, these older films.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate you being here.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I did try to do the TikTok thing, tie it in with both podcasts a little bit, talk a little bit about the films we're going to be covering on either show or anything. And it just, I probably haven't posted anything on it in over a year. It feels like it's a full-time job to try to come up with the content, even for just a 30-second or a one-minute video. And try to keep it interesting. And I'm terrible with the, okay, I'm going to talk about this film and try to do it on the cuff. And I'm like, I can't. You know, I feel like I need some amount of script, but then I feel like I'm not looking at the camera because I'm looking at the script, and it feels weird. And then just finding the time. So the fact that you were able to do it and that you have actually been able to find some modicum of success doing it, be props to you, and I applaud you on your effort.
Yeah, you can see the green screen behind me. So this is what I use for my Momitu intros, and actually now my channel intros. But then I also built a you can see it here. How do I angle this? There we go. A teleprompter. So I made myself a teleprompter so I can record my scripts while looking at the camera.
There you go. That's the step. I didn't need to think about that. you got the brain moving now.
It's a binder and picture frame glass, and my phone sits right behind it, and I can record my scripts much more easily now. And I slide an iPad in underneath, and that's what reflects up on the glass.
Oh, very clever, you.
Well, gotta use what I have. I would love, there's a thing called It's from a company called Elgato. It's called the Prompter, and it's just, it's a little teleprompter. It's probably about, I don't know, this big or so. It's about the size of an alarm clock. And it would replace this in a heartbeat. It's just, it's a teleprompter, and you hook it up to your phone or whatever, and you know, you can stream your text there, but it's like $250. This cost me like $10 to make. So
because I haven't posted much on TikTok, I haven't been very active on TikTok at all lately, but I will definitely have to start getting on there more often and seeing more of the videos as you do in more real time versus, oh, I'm going back 6 months and watching this, something that you watched and that you posted ages ago, and interact a little bit more with you and hopefully connect with some of the other classic film fans that follow you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've got playlists on my channel, so you know, if anyone who's listening to this wants to go check it out, I'm at Lobby Intros on TikTok. I've got, playlists for like my classic film introductions, my Hollywood history stuff. I've got playlists for my Hays Code and my Blacklist documentaries. They're in 5 separate parts. And then I've been doing the series on cartoons and their classic film references. So like when The Simpsons does a Treehouse of Horror and they do a classic film reference, or, you know, they did like a whole episode with Sideshow Bob that was essentially a parody of Cape Fear, you know, that kind of stuff. Family Guy is one of my favorite shows because Seth MacFarlane is such a fan of old films and old musicals, and he goes deep, like way deep on certain references.
I'd love to get him on this show.
Same. I would love to talk to him, like have a 2-hour conversation with him about his passions of classic film. And he's also a terrific singer.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I would just sit here dumbstruck and probably just occasionally wipe.
I'm not gonna lie, I'd probably be the same.
I was just gonna say, I'm glad I'm not glad I'm not alone.
Yeah. He's phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, let's end, Harry, with letting you please tell everybody the places that they can find you. That would be probably the best place to start bringing this to a close.
Sure. So you can find me on TikTok at Lobby Intros. My channel's name is Let's All Go to the Lobby. You can find me on Instagram at Lobby_intros, because some jerk already had Lobby Intros. And then you can find me on Momitu and their YouTube channel. And I do, I'm their classic film host. So I do the intros for, right now I think there's about 6 or 7 intros up. We just started working together a couple months ago, and there will be many more to come.
Excellent. And Harry, thank you very much for coming on and talking with us. This has been an absolute blast. Maybe we'll have to have you maybe on another time, and we'll have a little bit more focused conversation. We'll pick an actor or a film in particular to talk about, we'll see where that conversation takes us.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you for having me. Yeah. If you want to talk Bogart or, in terms of modern actors, I feel like Michael Shannon is today's Bogart. I think he's terrific. I think he could play any role. And he's so cool. And I think he needs to be given the chance to do a Casablanca or a In a Lonely Place kind of film to really, you know, be highlighted and be the leading man. I know he is, but yeah. Anytime.
Excellent. Yeah, Lydia and I have joked in the past on the show that it's really funny that our celebrity crushes have been dead for like 50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I have others, but you say David Niven and I just go weak in the knees.
Yep. Yeah, it's Gene Tierney and Rita Hayworth and yeah, Ava Gardner. Yep.
They're so classy.
I've definitely become a Myrna Loy, you know, is makes the heart.
Oh, I have a crush on Myrna Loy.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
My husband probably does too, but I also have, she's phenomenal.
And then we discovered she's become one of the favorite actors to show up on the show is Evelyn Brent. We think is just phenomenal. She's another actress that just, we love to death.
But that's great.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, Harry, thank you very much. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I can't wait till we get a chance to talk again.
Likewise. This is great. Thank you so much.